So chapter 10, verse 1 began, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel." But you may remember, if you were here last week, that within chapter 10 itself, we didn't find out the content of that word. Chapter 10 was all introductory to it. Now, however, in this evening's passage, we do find out the content of that word. And you won't be surprised then to hear it's about the future. And it covers basically the same ground that we've been in fairly often in these latter stages of Daniel, only, as you will have realized, in greater length. Actually, it connects our passage this evening particularly well with that little section that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. This evening's passage is really just those four verses, chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, kind of unpacked in lots of detail. There are three main periods featured in our passage this evening, and those three periods featured there in chapter 9 as well. And so this evening we're going to walk through those three periods in our passage, but I'm going to give them the labels which they had back there in chapter 9. I hope that makes sense. So first of all then, the 62 weeks. The 62 weeks. So if you go back to chapter 9, verse 25, and the last part of that verse, it refers to a period of 62 weeks. Remember, we're not to think literally of that amount of time, but 62 weeks does at least indicate a big chunk, a relatively lengthy spell. And what happens during those 62 weeks? Well, according to chapter 9, verse 25, Jerusalem functions again. Jerusalem exists again during these 62 weeks. In other words, this is the period following the rebuilding of the city. You remember how King Cyrus, he sent back the Jewish exiles to Judah and decreed that Jerusalem should be rebuilt. And so now that's happened, and throughout these 62 weeks, Jerusalem exists again. But, chapter 9, verse 25 says, it exists in a troubled time. In a troubled time. And so those 62 weeks then mentioned in chapter 9, verse 25, they are the first period covered in our passage this evening. And they're covered in verses 2 to 20 of Daniel 11. And what we discover really in these 19 verses is that chapter 9 wasn't overstating things when it called that period a troubled time. If anything, it was being euphemistic. I mean, these 19 verses here, they're just a catalogue, aren't they, of conflicts, of attacks and counterattacks. I suspect as I read them, you soon found yourself in a fog of total incomprehension. Well, I haven't time to elucidate all the details this evening, but I'll just quickly map out the contours of these 19 verses. So verse 2 indicates that the Persian Empire, under which Daniel is now living, it will continue for some time. The verse ends, however, with a reference to the kingdom of Greece. The kingdom of Greece would conquer and supplant the Persian Empire. And verse 3 describes the particular Greek ruler who would cause that to happen, this mighty king, as he's described, namely Alexander the Great. He's given little coverage in the passage, however, because verse 4 then takes us straight to his demise and to the subsequent division of the Greek kingdom into four. Of its four parts, however, two would become dominant. And that's why from verse 5 onwards, the focus is on the kings of the south, based in Egypt, and the kings of the north, based in Syria. So verses 6 to 9 describe various initial marriage alliances and military clashes that would occur between the south and the north. And then in verses 10 to 19, the focus is on one fairly notable king of the north, namely Antiochus III. Now, we've talked a lot in this series about Antiochus IV, and we will do so again. This is his father. And as I say, he's a notable figure in his own right. And so he would suffer an initial defeat to the king of the south, verse 11, it's described there. But afterwards, he would be successful. Notice, indeed, the same phrase is used of him as was used of Alexander the Great back in verse 3 and will be used of his son later on, namely, he does as he wills, verse 16. He does as he wills. Eventually, however, his career would hit the buffers. That's described rather frankly in verse 19. He stumbles and falls and is not found anymore. And he would be succeeded then initially not by his notorious son Antiochus, because Antiochus would have an older brother, but that older brother would be assassinated, and that's what's referred to at the end of verse 20, broken neither in anger nor in battle. So those then, as I say, are the contours of verses 2 to 20, these 62 weeks in chapter 9's terms. And I'm sure you can see then that they are indeed a troubled time. Chapter 9, verse 25 wasn't wrong about that. But I think that while chapter 9, verse 25 and chapter 11, verses 2 to 20 both depict these 62 weeks as a troubled time, the two passages are making different points about that. The point in chapter 9 was something like this. Daniel, the angel was saying, Gabriel was saying, Daniel, don't set your hopes on the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Don't set your hopes on the end of the 70 years prophesied by Jeremiah. That's not going to usher in any kind of golden age. It's not going to trigger a return to the glory days of David and Solomon. Yes, Jerusalem will exist again, but her existence will be this precarious business in a troubled time. So look beyond that, Daniel. Look to something much more exciting that lies way further down the line. That was the point being made in chapter 9. But Daniel's gotten that point now, and he doesn't need to learn that lesson again. And I think then, as I say, that chapter 11 is making a different point. When you read verses 2 to 20, there's something that really stands out, and it's this. The sheer amount of to-ing and fro-ing between the kings of the south and the kings of the north. I mean, you can't miss it, can you? It begins in verse 6, where we have the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north. Then again in verse 7, the king of the south shall enter the fortress of the king of the north. You have it again in verse 9. The king of the south shall come into the king of the north shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. You have it again in verse 10, where you have the king of the north passing through and going as far as the fortress of the king of the south. You have it again in verse 11, where the king of the south comes out and fights against the king of the north. You have it again in verse 13, where the king of the north raises a multitude against the king of the south. You have it again in verse 15, the king of the north comes up and fights the king of the south. And so on and on it goes. You know how football commentators will talk about a match being end to end. In other words, the action just keeps shifting from one end of the pitch to the other. And this then is end-to-end stuff that we're getting here in this passage. And we're meant to read the passage, I think, with a map in our minds. And we're meant to realize that if the kings of the south are constantly heading north towards Syria, and if the kings of the north are constantly heading south towards Egypt, then Judah, which lies bang in between, is constantly being passed through by these mighty forces. Which means then that the continued existence of the rebuilt city of Jerusalem throughout these 62 weeks, as the kings of the south are coming from one direction and the kings of the north are coming from the other direction, the continued existence of this rebuilt city of Jerusalem throughout these 62 weeks is nothing less than a minor miracle. When Isaac was little, we were on holiday in Scotland, and one day after hours on the beach, we were back in our accommodation, and we couldn't find the SIM card from the camera that we'd been using that day. And on that card were lots of photos from Isaac's infancy that we didn't want to lose, and so we decided we must go back to the beach to look for this thing. The beach was an hour's drive away, and so we got in the car and set off, and we didn't have all that much hope. The card was so tiny, and the sun was starting to set, and the spot we'd been sitting on the beach, it was near the path where lots of feet would have trampled the car deep into the sand. But we eventually arrived back at the beach car park. I ran onto the beach and to the spot where we'd been sitting, and it took about 2 seconds to find the car. There it was, lying in the sand. We couldn't believe it. All those people toing and froing across that stretch of sand for all those hours, and it was still there. And that's the point here. These 62 weeks, these heavyweight kingdoms toing and froing across tiny, fragile Jerusalem, and it's still there by the end of that period. I'm saying this passage then, it has a fresh perspective for us on Jerusalem existing in a troubled time. Its perspective is this: what a God preserving his holy city amidst all of this. And you know, it is amazing when God preserves like that. Perhaps we don't recognize this kind of thing enough. Paul recognizes it. In 1 Thessalonians, it's very striking, that letter, as Paul talks about the Thessalonians coming to Christ, and coming to Christ through his ministry, and he, Paul, then having to leave them. And once he's left them, he knows that this young, fragile church has had to suffer various forms of persecution. And this is what he says at the end of 1 Thessalonians 2. He says, "Since we were torn away from you, brothers, for a short time, in person, not in heart, we endeavored the more eagerly and with great desire to see you face to face." And he says at the beginning of verse of chapter 3, "When we could bear it no longer, we were willing to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother and God's co-worker, to establish and exhort you in the faith, that no one be moved by these afflictions." It says again in verse 5, "When I could bear it no longer, I sent to learn about your faith for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain." You see Paul's fear here. He's worried that this fragile little church, this new church in Thessalonica, with this suffering that's now come to it, it's just gone. And then he continues, verse 6, "But now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us the good news of your faith and love and reported that you always remember us kindly and long to see us as we long to see you," he goes on, "now we live because you are standing fast in the Lord." It's Paul running onto the beach, and the little SIM card is still there. The Thessalonian church, it's still there. All these forces wanting to crush it. And Paul has heard now from Timothy, it's still there. And you can sense the adoration that he sends to, he directs to God, who has preserved this church. Charles Wesley recognizes the same thing, doesn't he, in that hymn we just sang. "All are not lost or wandered back. All have not left thy church and thee. There are who suffer for thy sake. Enjoy thy glorious infamy. Esteem the scandal of the cross and only seek divine applause. And we should recognize this phenomenon as well, shouldn't we, as we look around this room this evening, as we see older Christians who have been on the narrow path for decades perhaps. We should say, wow, they're still there. As we see Christians who have battled really hard circumstances over the years. Wow, they're still there. As we see Christians who have backslidden at points, who have spent time in the far country, a long way from the Heavenly Father, but they've come back. Wow, they're still here tonight. It should fill us with praise, shouldn't it, for our preserving God, his preservation of individuals and churches. It might not be as spectacular as some of his other works, but it's wonderful nonetheless, this preservation of his city throughout these 62 weeks. His preservation of that Thessalonian church, his preservation of you all the years until now. What a God we have who keeps his people amidst their battles and their struggles. So that's the first period covered in our passage, the 62 weeks. The second period covered, the one week. So again, if you go back to chapter 9, verse 27 talks about a 1 week period. And it refers then to this nameless he. He shall do this, he shall do that. And we said when we looked at that passage that the he there is Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, as he's often known. And that 1 week period then, and again, of course, we're not literally thinking about that amount of time. That 1 week period, that's the second period covered in our passage this evening. And it's covered then from verse 21 of chapter 11 all the way down to verse 1 of chapter 12. This passage is dominated, this section of the passage is dominated by this ruler, Antiochus the Fourth. And we learn here much more about him than we've learned so far in the book. We learn, for instance, and we've touched on this already this evening, that he wasn't the rightful heir to the throne. He had an older brother, but that older brother was assassinated. Antiochus may himself have been part of the assassination. That's not entirely clear. But that's why we read in verse 21 that in his place then shall arise a contemptible person, that's Antiochus the Fourth, to whom royal majesty has not been given. In other words, he's not the rightful heir to the throne. Then again, we learn here that like his father, he engaged in warfare with the kings of the south of Egypt. The passage mentions two campaigns, one that's successful, verses 25 and 26, and one that's not successful, verses 29 and 30, where he's forced to withdraw from battle. Then again, we learn something of his character here as well, especially his ability to win friends and influence people. So verse 21 refers to his flatteries. He obtains the kingdom by flatteries. Verse 24 talks about him scattering among them, the middle of the verse, scattering among them plunder, spoil and goods. That means scattering among his loyal supporters, plunder, spoil and goods. In other words, he knew how to keep people's loyalty by giving them lots of stuff. You have again that same emphasis in verse 39, the middle part of that verse, those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honour. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land between them. And that's also then, I think, what's going on, this kind of ability to win friends and influence people. It's also what's going on in verses 37 and 38. These verses look like they contain a contradiction, because we're told in verse 37... that he shall not pay attention to any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But then we're told in verse 38 that he shall honour the god of fortresses a God whom his fathers did not know, and so on. So it's verse 37 seems to be saying that he doesn't worship any God, he just worships himself. Verse 38 does talk about him worshiping another God. And the point here is that he abandoned the worship of Apollo, which you would have expected him, like his fathers, to have worshipped, and he worshipped instead the god Zeus, which the purpose of which was to unify the kingdom. Because again, he's thinking purely pragmatically. He's not thinking in terms of principle. It's not that he's a convinced believer in this god, but he wants to do what will most unite the kingdom and what will be in his best interest. And so that's why, in a sense, he was worshipping himself. Yes, he was worshipping this god Zeus, the god of fortresses, but at the same time, he was really just worshipping himself because he was doing it for his own interests. So, as I say, we learn kind of new information about Antiochus in these verses. But once again, the focus is really on his assaults upon Jerusalem and upon the worship of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And so in verse 28, we have this statement, his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant. That's against the covenant of between Yahweh and his people and all that that entailed. Verses 30 and 31 again show this side of Antiochus. Verse 30, he will be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. Verse 31, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple. We've seen that already, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. We've talked about that already, how he stopped the sacrifices being offered in the temple to Yahweh. And then verse 36, he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. That, of course, is Yahweh. And in this connection then, in connection with his assaults on Jerusalem and the people of God and the worship of God, I just want to quickly highlight two things here. First of all, the purpose behind Antiochus. Now, as soon as I say that, you might be thinking, I know exactly what you're going to say, Dan. You're going to say that behind Antiochus, there are demons at work, because we talked about that last week, and behind the demons, perhaps, we can say Satan is at work. We've seen that in Revelation 12, haven't we? We've been there a couple of times in this series. And the picture we're given there of Satan, the red dragon, throughout the Old Testament period, attacking and attacking and attacking the people of God. Why? Because he wants to stop Messiah being born. He wants to break the pipeline from which the Savior will come. And so that's the purpose then that's operating behind Antiochus. It's demons and Satan. Well, yes, that's true. But we can go further back than that. Let's look at verses 32 to 35, a key little section here. In verses 32 to 35, we're given a fascinating insight into the Jews' reactions then to Antiochus. We're told in verse 32 of some who will be seduced by him. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. I think I referred to this before, so that some of the Jews would kind of buy into the whole Greek agenda of Antiochus and become supporters of his, and they would violate the covenant and they would side with Antiochus. That's what some did. Others, however, will stand firm, we're told at the end of that verse. And not only will they stand firm, but they will take action. And that's not referring to armed resistance, although some Jews at that time did offer armed resistance to Antiochus. But rather, the action that they will take is described in the next verse: they shall make many understand. In other words, they would not only kind of stand up themselves against Antiochus, but they would exhort their brothers and sisters to do the same and to be faithful to God, and they would seek to persuade other Jews to also take a stand and also be loyal to Yahweh. And for doing this, then, they would suffer. There's this reference to them stumbling, verse 33, by sword and flame, captivity and plunder. And we're not to think of stumble here in the sense of sin, you know, to him who is able to keep you from stumbling, Jude. That's not the kind of stumbling. It's the same kind of stumbling we've had back in verse 19. It's kind of falling dead through these things. So some would suffer martyrdom, or at least come close to martyrdom, through sword and flame, captivity and plunder. Interestingly, these verses seem to indicate that some actually would take the right side in all this, but for the wrong reasons. As the end of verse 34, many shall join themselves to them, that's to the faithful Jews, with flattery, or insincerity, I think the NIV has it, which is probably better here. Perhaps it's referring then to some who took the right side, but simply for nationalistic reasons, rather than because they really were devoted to Yahweh. But anyway, regardless of the insincerity of some, there would be many who would stand firm, and they would stand firm for this reason, verse 32, because they know their God. What a wonderful concept that isn't it? Those who know their God shall stand firm. Reminds us, and I guess we touched on this last week, didn't we, that the greatest preparation that we can make for days that may lie ahead, when it will become harder and harder to be a Christian in our society, the greatest preparation we can be making is this: knowing God better. Remember how Daniel, what did he need to see before he saw this frightening vision that we're looking at tonight? What did he need to see first? He needed to see God. Remember, that's what we saw in chapter 10. Daniel just being abased, being dismantled before the glory and majesty of God. Because if we're going to stand up to persecution, to opposition, to hostility, what we need more than anything is an expansive vision of God. It's when we fear him that we'll not fear those who are opposing us in society. And so these people, they'll stand because they know their God. But this is the thing. Look at verse 35. And we're told there that some of the wise men shall stumble, that is, they shall suffer. Why? Well, we know why from Satan's perspective. From Satan's perspective, Revelation 12, it's so that he can wipe out the Jews so that Jesus can't be born. But here we get a completely different purpose, don't we? God's purpose, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. So you see, here's Satan, and he's desperately trying to break the pipeline from which Jesus will come. And not only does his persecution through Antiochus fail to do that, it's actually counterproductive. All it does is it produces holier people in Jerusalem. People who are cleaner and whiter and more devoted to Yahweh. Satan's desperate attempts to stop Jesus coming, it all comes back in his own face. It's all counterproductive. And the result is something that he would have absolutely hated. It's these people, through their suffering, being more beautiful and holy than ever. Isn't that what Paul's getting at in Romans 8? Remember how he talks about, he says this, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? And I said before, it's who, not what. Who shall separate us? I think he has in mind Satan, who of course will try to do that. And he carries on then, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? Shall Satan be able to use any of these things to separate us from Christ's love? And this is his answer. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors. In the Greek, hyper-conquerors, Paul says, through him who loved us. And what does Paul mean by that? You can understand if he said, through all these things, we are conquerors. In other words, no, we're not separated from Christ's love. We conquer. Why does Paul say we're more than conquerors? We're hyper-conquerors. I think again it's this point that Satan's desperate attempt through trouble and hardship and persecution and all the other things Paul mentions, Satan's desperate attempt to separate us from Christ's love, it actually doesn't merely fail, it's counterproductive for him. Because it makes us more like Christ. It makes us more beautiful. It makes us more devoted to the triune God. So we're not just conquerors, we're hyper-conquerors. Satan's attempts to separate us become a springboard to us being more holy and more Christ-like than ever. That's the purpose behind the purpose. God's purpose behind Satan's purpose. So the purpose behind Antiochus. And then the other thing to notice here, the end of Antiochus. So verse 40 begins, at the time of the end, not talking about here the end of history, it's the same end that we read of in verse 45, his end. That's Antiochus' end. So verses 40 to 45 are going to tell us about Antiochus' end, how he fell, how he was brought down. But this is the thing. In these verses, we have a complete change of approach that you can easily miss when you're reading them. You probably did, because it's very easy to miss. What we have in verses 40 to 45 is no longer a detailed foretelling of the future, so that you can go to the history books, to Josephus and others, and say, ah yes, that's that verse, and how it was fulfilled. Ah yes, that's how that verse was fulfilled. You can't do that with verses 40 to 45. Instead, what the angelic messenger does in verses 40 to 45 is this. He piles up allusions to Isaiah's prophecies concerning the success and demise of Assyria several centuries earlier. So we haven't got time to look up the references, but I'll just give you them in case you're dubious about this. So in verse 40, Antiochus is likened to a storm, or a whirlwind, the ESV has it, and to a flood overflowing. And that language is the exact same language as is used of the king of Assyria in Isaiah 8, verses 7 to 8, and Isaiah 28, verse 2. Then in verse 44, we have this idea of Antiochus hearing news that alarms him, and so going back to sort out this problem. Well, that's an echo, isn't it, of what happened to the king of Assyria in Isaiah 37, verse 7. Sennacherib, he heard a report. He was attacking Judah. He heard a report, and so he had to go back to sort the problem out. And then verse 45 talks about Antiochus meeting his final end in the Holy Land, between the sea and the Mediterranean and the glorious mountain. And again, there's echoes of Isaiah 14:25, where it said the king of Assyria will be broken in my land, Yahweh says, on my mountains. And so there are all these echoes, these allusions to Assyria here in verses 40 to 45. What's the point of that? Well, I think the point is this. Antiochus was going to be unprecedented in his savagery and his brutality, and particularly his savagery and brutality against the people of God. You get a sense of the unprecedented nature of it if you look at chapter 11, verse 24. It talks about him doing what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done. Or if you go to chapter 12, verse 1, a time of trouble he will bring on such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. So you get these touches of how unprecedented Antiochus's savagery and brutality is going to be. And yet, you see, what verses 40 to 45 are saying is this, that however new and unprecedented Antiochus's horrors may be, for Yahweh, bringing him down will be just like another day at the office. It will just be another superpower he brings down, just like Assyria all those centuries earlier. It's no different to Yahweh. From the human horizontal perspective, this might seem like a new challenge that's just completely different to anything that's gone before. This eclipses Babylon or Persia or Assyria. To Yahweh, it's just another Assyria. And he can bring it down just as easily. It's like when you use that phrase, you know, someone is a bit patronizing toward you and is kind of trying to give you help that you don't really need, and you say, look, I was doing this thing before you were even born. And that's kind of the message here. Yahweh is saying, I was bringing down superpowers, Daniel, before you were even born. Antiochus is nothing to worry about. I've brought down many powers before him, and I'll bring him down in just the same way. And we need to take that with us, actually, into this week, that whatever threats and challenges we may find, we may encounter in our lives this week, and we cry out to God, please help me in this situation, this temptation, this difficult circumstance, this dilemma, which to us just seems huge, like it's worse than anyone's ever faced in history before. To our God, it's just another day at the office. He's dealt with challenges like those since the Garden of Eden onwards. And so that's the perspective that this passage is getting across. And so the 62 weeks, the 1 week, and then just very briefly as we close, what I'm going to call the new era. Now that language, the new era, wasn't used back in chapter 9, but if you go back to chapter 9 and look at verse 24, do you remember that verse? 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish their transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness. And we said then that verse 24 is kind of looking beyond Antiochus to the new era that Jesus would bring in and to the achievements of Jesus. That's what verse 24 of chapter 9 is all about. And similarly then, our passage closes with Daniel being shown beyond Antiochus to Jesus. Remember we said there in chapter 9, verse 24, that like the other Old Testament prophets, in Daniel you don't get a clear sense of the distinction between Jesus' first coming and Jesus' second coming. So there in verse 24 of chapter 9, there are some blessings that are more connected with his first coming, like sin being atoned. Some blessings that are more connected with the second coming, everlasting righteousness being brought in. There's this kind of mingling. Well, here at the end of our passage, from chapter 12, 1 to 4, the focus is on the blessings that Jesus will bring at his second coming and this deliverance. At that time, middle of verse 1, your people shall be delivered. And it becomes clear this is the deliverance that Jesus will bring ultimately, at the very end itself. Notice the nature of this deliverance. What is it? It's resurrection. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. And we've talked, haven't we, in 1 Corinthians 15 in recent months about resurrection, about how our resurrection will not simply be a resumption of our present existence, but an enhancement of it. And you get that sense here, this reference to bright, these references to brightness. Those who are wise, having been raised, shall shine like the brightness of the sky above. What a prospect, our resurrection glory. So there's the nature of this deliverance. Notice the objects of this deliverance. It's those whose names are found written in the book, verse 1. And this then is talking about God's electing purposes, that God has chosen those who will be his and will be delivered. And it's all of his gracious determination, so that on that day when we're brought out of the graves, we won't turn to each other and say, didn't we do well? We'll turn to each other and say, wow, why us? Why such love toward us? Why were our names written in the book? That's the point there. And then the duration of this deliverance. There's this emphasis in verse 3 on shining like the stars forever and ever, of being awoken to everlasting life. Perhaps a contrast with the kind of tumult of chapter 11, verses 2 to 20 that we looked at the beginning this evening, where you have all these kind of human victories, these earthly powers winning victories, and yet in every case they're undone again, aren't they? The king of the south wins a victory, and then it's undone as the king of the north comes back at him. The king of the north wins a victory, and then it's undone as the king of the south comes back at him. That's history, isn't it? Everything's constantly in flux. Everything's done and then undone again. Not just in politics, sport as well. I remember chatting once to Andrew and Linda's son, Peter, and him explaining why he's not that into football, because he says, well, you know, you get to the end of a season and someone's won and then it all starts again. And it'd be so much more satisfying if there could be one great victory that's kind of the final victory. And there's some truth in that, isn't there? You know, next season Barcelona could thrash Liverpool and it'll all be forgotten what happened this past week. And here at the end of our passage, we're being shown a victory that will not be undone like that. Our victory, when Jesus raises us, we will shine forever like the stars. Not for a period until Satan comes again and reverses it, but forever. This victory that will last. And so, this vision then, as I say, filling out the brevity of chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. And ultimately pointing us to Jesus and to his final return and that deliverance in resurrection. May God sustain us with that hope. Amen. Well, let's close singing number 487, Amazing Grace.